Welcome to the latest episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me in studio is Maria. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. You?
I'm very good, thank you so much. And special guest Wells Jones. How are you, Wells?
I'm doing very well from Santa Fe, New Mexico, USA.
Yes, for us in Madrid, it's 6:30 in the evening. What time is it in your part of the world?
It is 11:30, and that's because there's been a time change. It's daylight savings. We practice, crazy as it is, going, let's see, spring forward an hour and fall back. So in the spring, we did it on Sunday, move the clocks 1 hour ahead. And in the fall, we'll move it back. We'll fall back an hour. And at some point, maybe the country will decide to keep it one time zone, one time, you know?
Yeah, it is a controversial thing. Even over here in Europe, some people are arguing that it should be done away with completely. But you're joining us anyway on the other side of the world. It's a real pleasure having you here. And in this podcast, we've interviewed teachers, writers, photographers, all manner of people. And I believe this is the first time we have an adventurer on the podcast. So could you tell our audience, just to start off, to get the ball rolling, in the 21st century, what does it mean to be an adventurer?
Well, Inda, I think we have to define what an adventure is. And I've recently started doing podcasts because of the book that we'll be talking about a little bit later, to introduce the book and my experiences with my co-author, Miles Spencer. His separately and mine and together. At any rate, on one podcast that I was on, I listened to a mountaineer discuss a very accomplished mountaineer. This is someone that's done Everest a number of times. You know, that seems to be the apex of climbing in the world, or it's K2, the big mountains. And he defined it with five elements that are necessary to have an adventure. And I'll tell you what they are. High endeavor is number one, not in number one over these others, but just the first one. Uncertain outcomes, total commitment, tolerance for adversity, and great companionship. And when I heard that, I have thought about adventure, and I thought that's brilliant, that's wonderful, but it's relative. You can be a mom, dad, an individual that has a baby in a carriage. You're in the house, you put the baby in the carriage, a child, and you pack up with food. You know you're going to go to the park, you have to cross the streets, there's danger, there could be adversities. It's uncertain outcomes, but you know the weather looks good, but it might start raining. But you still have this desire to go and to have this adventure. Mine have come out of, I think it's more a mindset for me, but I will add a sixth element to what Matt Walker, this mountaineer that takes people up Everest and many different mountains around the world. And I found that I had to have purpose, to the adventure. Because it took away a level of ego about it. Oftentimes, and for a while, but not long, it was, you hear the phrase peak bagging. It's like, well, how many times did you do that mountain? Well, how many times did you do that one? And how much elevation gain did you get? You know, do you have pictures? And all of that mean, if that's not my drive, that's not what gets me up the mountain, if it is a mountain, or through a production that's on the Kennedy Center stage, and I've never directed one there before. But the qualities that it takes to load the child in the carriage, or to get your gear together, they're all the same. You have to have, you know, you have to be curious, you have to have levels of adaptability. You have to trust, you have to have a conscientiousness, you have to have a situational awareness around you. And so for me, adventure has been all the time. I mean, the first one was probably, I was born abroad, army family, large family, 6 children, 3 birthdays, 2 sets of twins, and I have a brother born on my first birthday. So 6 kids, 6 years of age. And we ended up in South Carolina, started school there, and then moved to Vermont, which was a big, big change. We're talking about going from nice warm weather, you know what I mean, to snow and mud in the springtime. At any rate, that whole sense of adventure started there, and it just continued with my life. And I felt like I have been tapped on the shoulder to do very adventurous things, or I treated them that way and greeted them even when there was adversity. And so today, with the way the world is evolving, we'll have to treat it as a level of an adventure, a level of fate, a card hand that we're given and that we accept, and we're going to see it through, because there's going to be rocky days, particularly with the political situation in the United States. It's such a radical change, and it's affecting the world. And so adventure has been, you know, you've seen my resume, and it's not something that I said, oh, I want to do that. It's I was tapped to do it. I know this is a long answer. One last thing. I want to just say that there is a quote from Winston Churchill that I found when I was a young man, young guy in high school. And it hit me so strong. It's no different than, I don't know if you know about Boy Scouts, and the motto of the Boy Scouts is be prepared. And I wasn't a Boy Scout, but I heard it on in advertisings or somewhere I heard it. But this Churchill quote, I'm going to read it. To each there comes in their lifetime a special moment when they are figuratively tapped on the shoulder and offered the chance to do a very special thing, unique to them and fitted to their talents. What a tragedy if that moment finds them unprepared or unqualified for that which could have been their finest hour. And that sent my imagination, and I said, I have no idea where I'm going to go, but I know I want to travel, see the world, and engage and have a family, have children, you know, have a home, but at the same time, see it all as a level of adventure. So there, that's my final answer.
Very powerful, very powerful.
Okay, good. Any questions?
Yeah, definitely. Well, we have lots of questions. Oh, we want to know lots of things, because obviously what you said, I think it's very interesting in many dimensions, because it's not just, you know, your own experience, like a practical experience, but it's also a way, like a philosophy for life, I guess, could be said. And we know you have many strings to your bow. We're going to be talking about all the different things that you do. But one of the things you are is a survival instructor. So I find this interesting, because not only you wanted to do this, but also you wanted to, or you want to somehow teach others how they can achieve it. And that also took you to retracing the steps of D. Lawrence. So can you tell us a little bit more about that? How did that happen, you know, by chance as well? Was it something that developed over time?
Well, they're almost at the opposite ends of the stick, or the timeline. In the beginning, I decided not to pursue university out of high school. I had a motto that became our class motto, and my class size was 31 people, and that was 5 towns representing. It was a union high school, and my senior class had 31. From 5 areas in a 25 square mile. And so it's very rural. My motto and the class decided that they wanted to use it as our graduation model. And it's one man with courage makes a majority. and it resonated with me, you know, at 18 years old. And I've come to realize one man with courage inspires a majority. He's capable. And when I say he, I say they, the individual is capable of doing that. And so I was not ready to go on to college. I had no business. I just wasn't into it. I said to my mother at one point, I think I was in a junior, which is 11th grade in this school. And I said, oh, I feel like running away. And she said, what are you talking about? And I said, I just can't, I don't know what to do here. This is just not, I don't need this school or these people. I want to go over that horizon. And she said, if you cannot handle where you are in the moment, you have no business leaving it. Deal with where you are before you make your next move. Always. And so, ding. Okay, that resonated. And I realized, no college. She said, that's fine. What are you going to do? I said, I'm going to go in the Navy. And I'm going to do this, and I'll be able to go to college at a certain point. I'm going to fly jets. And this is in 1973, I'm talking like this. It didn't happen. When it came to that point, I was told by my commanding officer when I was leaving the Navy, I'll give you any place in the world you'd like to go. You've done very well here as a member of the Antarctic Pararescue Team and teaching survival to the crews and the scientists that were coming in, that were flying around Antarctica. And where would you like to go? I said, I'd like to go to college now. And I want to fly jets. He said, yes, I've heard. He said, I'm sorry, son, that's not going to happen. You're 6'3" and your eyes are not 20/20. And it's not possible. And so I had had the time in the service with the Antarctic Parachute Rescue Team it was a part of this organization that was flying planes in the Navy, naval aviation, flying planes for the National Science Foundation. The planes were flying doctors and researchers around Antarctica and for the Antarctic Research Program. It's held between October and February each year. It's the Southern Hemisphere, so it stays light basically 24 hours a day. And that's where I was tapped. Once I found out there was a team, I applied. It took 6 months of training and processing, skydiving being the first element that had to be overcome or accomplished, and I just loved it. I found it incredible. It was the first time I really was in control of my life. You know, you jump out of a plane, you're in control. And then you learn how to guide yourself and land where you need to land. And it was for rescue, Antarctic extreme climate rescue. And then survival from that and the training that we received through various organizations, mainly from the New Zealanders. There were mountaineers and rescue operators in New Zealand, in the South Island, in the Alps of New Zealand. They had a base in Ann Archer. We had McMurdo, which is where we flew to, and they had Scott Base, which was their Antarctic research program just a couple of miles away. So I learned how to climb, and I learned many, many things. I learned, then a little bit about capacity. In other words, understanding that whatever you think, you can go further. And that was in the 70s. I was young, but learning that it's a mindset and it was an adventure. And so from there, the adventures just continued, and they were varied, varied, different forms of adventure. But that's where it really started, with that foundation, with the Churchill quote, with my mother saying, handle where you are now, which means I have been on trails in just raging storms, snow and water, different times of the year, and having to deal with it. You know, the obstacle is the way. What impedes, the impediment to action presents the action, what you need to do. And so these pieces just seemed to become a part of me. And as I met people, I was tapped and asked to do very exciting, wonderful things.
You mentioned being tapped and the quotes from Churchill and the class motto, and there's a real sense of you having this emotional and intellectual openness to this life of being an adventurer. I'm just curious at the same time, and I imagine the answer is yes, considering you mentioned your stint in the army, that not only were you consciously or unconsciously, or maybe a little bit of both, mentally preparing for this life of adventuring, that you're also physically preparing. Were you doing things in particular to get your body ready for these kind of things, or did that just come as a byproduct of being in the army? What was your approach to being physically ready for a life of adventure?
Well, it was just a correction there. It was the Navy.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me.
That's just fine because they do it in the army too. It is being prepared, and part of that preparation is it's mental and physical. I was not ever drawn to drugs or excessive alcohol. And so for me, my high, especially in the 70s, you know, was very wild time with Vietnam just wrapping up and the country at odds, civil unrest. And for me, I found that my peace would come out of running and running in the mountains. And it was something that I did before, you know, running in the mountains was as it is today, such a thing to do. And so it was sort of my gym, but the activities dictated what I needed to do, but also the activities themselves, climbing in and out of crevasses in Antarctica. It's called the ice. So if I say the ice, I'm always referring to Antarctica. Pulling gear together, doing rescue, mock rescues, doing real rescues, it all required a level of endurance. And that endurance was in the action of doing and being prepared. When I was doing production work, I would ride a bicycle on the weekends. And I just love the night. I love being out in it alone, especially in the wilderness, and with a goal, with a purpose, to get to the top, to see a sunrise, or to get to a certain area and on a bicycle. So I've always had physical activity, but it's not something that's I don't know. I'm not obsessive about it. It's just a part of my life. This morning I swam. Yesterday I did a mountain. Tomorrow I'll do a mountain. And when I say do a mountain, with the time change, it's a, you know, an hour ahead. So if I'm on the mountain at 5:30, it's pitch black and here just gorgeous stars and a moon. The moon's must be full now. I looked at this morning. And it's a part of who I am. I remember asking a man that did the Iditarod. Do you know what the Iditarod is? You ever heard of that?
No, not at all.
The Iditarod is a dog sled race in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's still going on. I don't know. You know, so many things have changed with animal protection awareness and that sort of thing. But I spoke with a man that had done it for years. And I said, John, what do you do to train? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, how do you train to do this? You know, it's, I don't know if it's 1,000 miles and Maria, it's something, it's massive and it's in the snow. And it's, you know, there have been movies about it. There are documentaries about it. And this guy finishes and ranks. And he said, I just work on the horse farm and do what I do. And when it comes time to go to Alaska, I've already run the dogs and I know, you know, we go. And it was because his lifestyle was set up that he just was always there. And it wasn't something that was a number. It wasn't his heart rate monitor. It wasn't this or that. It was that that was what he was going to do. And I loved that. And to this day, I've never worn an apparatus. And you can get iPhones that tell you, you know, how many beats per minute, how far you've run, how much you've, you know, everything. And I just don't touch that kind of stuff. You know?
That's really, it's nice when you're describing it because, you know, you're describing the landscape and I think, obviously, it's your own experience, but being able to put that into words and maybe to show that to other people through your experience, I think that's a really lovely thing. And we know you're actually an actor. You have a production company as well. So I imagine this, although it's a very different experience in the creative world, at the end of the day, I suppose you have a desire to not just to experience those things, but also to communicate and to share them with other people like you're doing with us. Would that be right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's part of, certainly as I move along in age, that it's needed. I see it in my sons. And there's respect. I see it in the, these podcasts. I hear it in the sense that if there is something that will lift or target a need or an affirmation that a person needs to get up and go, to do, to be accountable, to have less fear by overcoming the fear. It's okay to be afraid, but the fear, I mean, you know, but you can work through it and knowing that you can. And today, especially with young guys, they need someone to hear from someone that's been there, that's not just, you know, gloating on his, well, you know what, you got to really work hard to do this. And, you know, you do what you have to do to get it done. And the acting, it was a change from the pararescue, but it was a choice. And it was because I had a little taste of it in high school in that small space in Vermont. And I had the support. My mother said, "You're good. You should do it. You train. Just see, you know, you want to go all these places and be, experience all these things. Why don't you experience it through the lives of people that you'll be playing? Do Shakespeare. Do this." And it just opened my eyes up to another avenue to have an adventure. And for me, research, I've always loved research, finding out about people, places, the culture. And so it was not a big, hard transition because I was still running. I used to run around Central Park at night, the big loop. It's a 6.2 mile loop. And sometimes alone, once in a while with a friend. But so I never lost sight of filling my lungs with air, you know, and my head with ideas.
Apart from this kind of drive for fresh air, and I really like this poetic sensibility you mentioned in, you know, going to the mountain and seeing the stars and the moon. There's all these really amazing characteristics. And there's another one I want to touch on, which is generosity, because I know through your plays and educational performances and even through your kayaking as well, you've collaborated quite frequently with nonprofits and charities. So I'm just curious to know if this is as a result of traveling and coming back and having a broadened mind and seeing the world that makes you more disposed to that, or is this something that's separate from the traveling?
I think they all go hand in hand. And they, when Miles tapped me on the shoulder, that's the when we first met, with a television show, a PBS, his public broadcasting service here, to do a show called Money Hunt. There's another show on now that's called Shark Tank. Well, Money Hunt was before Shark Tank and actually more original. It was just a fabulous show. Don't need to get into it, excepting it was a show for venture capitalists and entrepreneurs to meet. And we would hear on the show an entrepreneur's business and his ask for a certain round of money to go forward. There would be two guests on the show. There would be Miles as a venture capitalist with the money, Cliff as an entrepreneurial attorney, and a guest mentor. So there was three people listening to one individual at a time, one company, lay it out, what they wanted, what they're about. And then the three people would decide between the two guests, entrepreneurs, which one would get an hour of time with a guest mentor. And that mentor was a big, big name. And that was wonderful. And back then, just to have 1 hour with Jerry Yang from Yahoo or Candace Carpenter from iVillage or Guy Kawasaki from GarageDuck, I mean, these names and these people were successful entrepreneurs as the guest mentors. I said to Miles, you know what would be really good? Is to do a social, what would we call it? You know, shows with foundations, like a social entrepreneur stuff, like foundations that are doing something that has a cause and a purpose, mm-hmm. that's not about just making money and being the number one in this field or that discipline or this, but something that is worthy. And it was just the germ of the idea. And from that, actually, that's when I was tapped on the shoulder to be a chief operating officer for a foundation in Washington, D.C. And I was there for 4 years, and it was intense. And I realized the work that people do dedicated to other people. And it really was an adventure with purpose. And in the case where I was the chief operating officer, it was an organization for young inner city girls, primarily African-American girls or Hispanic girls in 26 cities around the United States with the main headquarters in Washington, D.C. So the qualities that I learned in survival and teaching survival, you know, the detail is about how to get out of the wind, but it's the traits and the attributes and the skills you need in order to survive. And that can be turned into an adventure and not an adversity. It can be adverse. So I'm going back to that theme of the adventure, you know, being willing to see tough times and good times as an adventure, that it's something that you will go through. It won't stay static and the same. You will, you know, it's just natural that we'll go through it. And that I have found that the adventures with purpose, Kayak for a Cause was another one. Miles' idea about Money Hunt. It was Miles' idea about Kayak for a Cause. I mean, we inspired people that would learn to kayak or they already knew how to kayak across a body of water, Long Island Sound. I think it's somewhere between 12 and 13 miles. It's open water. Form a pod of 10 kayakers, raise money. They're all required to have, you know, raise a certain amount they would pay for their boat, their paddles, their flotation devices, and food. And then the money that's raised on top of that, we're going to write to charities. We're going to identify a number of charities that are local. They may be a part of an international organization, but the local chapter, And that night, after the paddling across Long Island Sound, we'll have a band and a party and award these checks. We worked up to 313 kayaks, raising enough money to give five charities $50,000 each.
Wow.
Have a party and have the Neville Brothers or Dickie Betts or the Wailers. These are different years that we'd have headliner bands, and pay for that all from the money that the paddlers raised. And we just tallied out at zero at the end. We gave the money away. We gave it back to the paddlers for doing such great work. We paid for the bands, and it was a fabulous adventure with purpose. And that was the second one that Miles and I did. And we've done a number, you know. We went to the Middle East.
That sounds incredible. Every time you're explaining something, it's like it takes you to a certain place, and you know, there's so much to it, not just the landscape, but the whole experience and the things that have inspired you, but also obviously you've inspired other people to do more things as well. So naturally, you know, you sort of expect that you would have written a book as well, because you like sharing what you do, and it's all very, very inspiring for everybody. So, well, you have a book that is called A Line in the Sun. So it's an epic adventure, of course, you expect no less. But, you know, the same way that you inspire other people, and that you have been inspired by certain situations where you felt that tap, specifically for books or for explorers, which ones would you say that have inspired you?
Number one would be T.E. Lawrence, a British man that was tagged Lawrence of Arabia. There's a film about him. And very definitely, there are several others, but T.E. Lawrence was brought into my life through having seen the film. And if you look the film up, Lawrence of Arabia, you'll see, you know, it was up for 11 Academy Awards. It won most of them. And it was an epic story about the Arab revolt during World War I and T.E. Lawrence's involvement. He was Lawrence of Arabia. And so I went deeper into him and to find out who he really was, because I wanted to do a one-man show. I was an actor, I had a family, young family, and I realized I must have something that I can do on my own, that I'm not relying on another producer to hire me, you know? And I had seen one-man show with Hal Holbrook doing Mark Twain, and I'd actually met Hal Holbrook and talked with him about this project. So I thought I would do Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence. And I started reading, and I read his Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And at some point, I found out that the man was 5 feet, 5 inches tall. And it's hit me as a blow, but a good blow, not because I'm 6'3". That he was able to do what he did. He was just a phenomenal individual and his knowledge. And so he, his writing, and the 50 plus biographies and movies and documentaries about him, that's the number one, the draw for me. And he influenced our trip. We've included him in the book, A Line in the Sand, by Miles Spencer and myself, Wells Jones. But there's a story to that. And I don't know if you were planning to ask me, but the book is based on a 2006 1,100 mile trek that Miles and I decided to do in 2005. And we trained for 8 months. to go to the Middle East. It's during the heat of the war. Previously, a year or so before, our president had landed on an aircraft carrier, and there was a huge sign that said, "Mission accomplished, we're done." Well, this is a year and a half from that, and it was just, you know, more horrific than ever with the headlines. And we, Miles and I met up. I had been running the foundation in DC, and I came back through and saw Miles with my family. And he asked me if I knew anything about Lawrence. I said, yes, I was going to do a one-man show. He's going, no way. I said, yeah. He said, that's what we need to do. You play Lawrence. I said, no. I'm not Peter O'Toole. Peter O'Toole was the actor. It's very stunning looking and an adventure. And I said, I'm not Peter O'Toole. You know, Lawrence wasn't Peter O'Toole. And he was 5'5" and a half. Anyway, we met a Broadway producer, and we've been working with her. I mean, we're in touch with her today, and it's been 20 years, and we've had four different writers writing a play that would be Broadway bound, is Broadway bound, that bridges an understanding of how we got into this Middle East mess. And it started during Lawrence's time with Faisal and his involvement and what he tried to make happen that didn't happen. And so the foundation to all of it goes back to the agreements, the declarations, the letters, the assurances, and then the Paris Peace Conference that just laid it out that the Middle East was going to be divided up between the British and the French, and there would be mandates and spheres of influence. And that's the basis for the anger. That's where it started there. And why did the British and the French do this? I mean, I know they were doing what they felt was right at the time, their highest thought of right, but it was oil. You see, resources, we hear it today. You know, the United States wants the resources of Ukraine. If you want any more help from us, we get your what a position to be in. So we did the track. We wanted to see with our own eyes, and we followed Lawrence's path. Why? Because he and his writings loved the people. They loved him. He understood them. Very tribal. He didn't try to change them. He didn't try to say, you stand here and you stand there. He worked with them. And when the lines were divided, literally, places that tribes had wells, we're talking about water, just water, wells that belonged to, there was in the path, the nomadic, the Bedouin people with their camels were shut off. Suddenly it's a whole different game. I mean, it's not something that, you know, you just write to the newspaper and complain. These people are out in the middle of the desert and they can't get from one place to the other because it's ruled by a third party where they can go, what they can do. Does that make sense?
Definitely, yeah. And you mentioned Peter O'Toole, a fine half Irish actor as well. So in our side of the world, some of his story and the fate that befell his Arab friends it's something that people are very curious about as well in our side of the world. And you've explained really well not only your trek and the political consequences of colonization in the previous century that still had its echoes today. And we'll definitely circle back to that in a moment with a subsequent question. But just focusing a little bit on your book, you know, you wrote it, as you mentioned, with your friend Miles Spencer. And the main protagonists of the book are two friends as well. So did you guys channel something of yourselves and your friendship into these two characters as well?
Absolutely. Yes. I'm Finn. He's Magnus. And we our story, you know, it's, some people said, okay, what's fiction and what's nonfiction? I mean, is it you? Is it him? And for the most part, about us and how we met, that's all accurate. And we did. We became friends, fast friends, lifelong friends the day we met. And we've done many exciting things together. So the story is based on actual happenings, but not nearly the magnitude of what we experienced on that 2006 trek from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, up north into Jordan, through Syria, and then into Israel, to see with our own eyes. And at the same time, we had a writer commissioned to write a play that's called A Line in the Sand play, featuring Lawrence. And we did not get a play from that writer. It just didn't work out. And we went on to other people. But so it was to see with our own eyes and with our feet in the sand. We've read so many books, biographies, but I don't know how, maybe one person had actually been to the Middle East that wrote the book about Lawrence. We wanted to go. And so we put our experiences into the book. And having worked for a number of years on the play, we realized that we didn't want to be pedantic, and to, if we wrote a nonfiction, it just wouldn't have the draw we felt for the reader to read and to glean the history at the same time. So the history is spot on. There's a travel device that takes us back to days, specific days in history with Lawrence. And the fiction was to entertain while it informs. The true story, the foundation to it, is the history. It's the story of Jeremy and Abdul, the young protégés of ours. Jeremy's Jew, Abdul's is Muslim, and they represent today love of country as individuals, their individual spaces, love of family, love of their religion, and total perplexity about how their government is handling the current, back then in 2006, current situation. And they both come, they met at a camp. And this is important because the camp is a real place, the summer camp. The real place is called Seeds of Peace. There you go, there's another foundation. Well, we did the same thing as we used the same model that we used for Kayak for a Cause. We raised money and gave a quarter of the money to Seeds of Peace, raised money for our Middle East trek, and gave money. And with that, and we met the leader of the Janet Wallach, whose husband actually started, but he had passed on. But we met with Janet, and she's a writer, and she knows a great deal about the Middle East. And she set it up that when we were in Saudi Arabia and in Amman, Jordan, and in Damascus, we met up with Seeds of Peace campers, people that had gone to the camp from their country, and in Israel, same. And it was just spectacular to actually talk with, you know, they were in their 20s by then, and talking of their experiences, Israeli man saying, well, I came back from the camp and the first thing that happened to me, I had to go to war. He went into the IDF because they have to serve in Israel. Mm-hmm. 2 years, 17 to 19. And of course the question becomes, was it difficult? Did you have to make, were you morally conflicted? Yes, yes, yes. And because of the way he responded and the look on his, the flush on of his face and his eyes, is like, do not ask him anything else. Are you still in that? The other than, are you still in touch with the people you went to camp with that are Muslim? Yes. I said, that's wonderful. You know, that's wonderful. So you made friends, yes. And the experiences, that alone was just magnificent. And to hear the campers years later, one girl said, you know, I went there and my mother said, you have no business doing this. And she's going, but mother, you know, I just want to understand what's going on. Well, we know what's going on. They're animals. They're this, they're that. And so she said, I will never say anything like that. I'm not like you, mom, and I'm not like dad. Well, this is a story that's repeated by a number of people that as soon as they at the camp ran into conflict, they started just spewing their mom and dad's prejudices on the attacking, you know, who was attacking them, and then breaking down and crying and just being so ashamed. And because they were there to learn conflict resolution, but the counselors said, this is good. That's exactly what we have to change the thinking. You're looking at, you know, Tali, you're looking at Tali. You know, she's not your mom. She's not the enemy. She's your friend. She camps here with you. And you're relating to her. Let's keep it that way. And not pile this other stuff on, because that's not her. And so the camp has been around since 1993. It's done great work, but you know, it's like little bits of sand on the beach, but it is good and it's necessary. So the book has a number of stories, a number of adult people. And what we found for the most part was that when they found out that we were American, wherever we were, particularly in Saudi, they almost shrunk and said, why are you here? And he said, we want to see with our own eyes. And they say, we're so sorry about what happened. Well, we don't know if we'll ever get our standing back with America. There's no one has come through. We can't go to America. And this is in 2006. And the level of contrition was huge. And being asked to go to dinner at His Royal Highness Prince Khalid bin Faisal bin Abdulaziz, after being a guest at his majlis, a meeting with his sheikhs that came in from the desert to talk about how things were in the province. And he walks through, this is late at night after the event, and he says, please, it's very good to have you here. Please join me for dinner. You'll see that we are not all terrorists. Humble, gentle. And we went, and there were the 50 sheikhs, and we were up on the dais, kind of a raised area, sitting next to the prince. And he explained to them that we were there as Americans to bridge an understanding, to see with our own eyes, and to meet the people. And we didn't understand what they were saying in Arabic, but they were nodding and staffs. These guys looked like they were out of Central Casting, as Moses and Ibrahim. I mean, they were right out of the desert, beards and layers of clothing and big wide belts around their girths and thick sandals and layers of clothing. And some had staffs, and you couldn't tell how old they looked. They all looked old, but they weren't, you know. And so that, along with 39 checkpoints, we were trained how to deal with it. And I've been asked, well, once you do a couple, you kind of have it down, don't you? I said, no way. Everyone is different. Everyone. And you have to be prepared, and you have to check yourself and not be bouncing around or on your phone. Are you kidding me? You know, no cameras. Sit still. Speak when spoken to. Have a smile. Be gracious. It's the number one thing our risk assessment, crisis management individual passed along. He said there's one thing that's universal around this world that he found. He's a SAS retired major with the Irish Guard. And he was, his name is Jamie Lowther Pinkerton. He was appointed the private secretary, appointed by the Queen private secretary to Prince Harry and Prince William for their security. And he had recently, it was over a year, had worked with Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman doing the same thing he was doing with us for their long way around motorcycle trip around the world. And so he said, it's graciousness, being gracious. It's that confident, quiet, slight smile. And it's the look in the eye, and you look directly into whoever you're talking to. You look them right in the eye and just speak. You know, and it's not, hey, man, what's going on? It's none of that. Yeah, cool. I dig your beard. Why is it half orange? None of that, you know, and learning how to, the customs, learning how to eat, learning how to sit, learning the custom of gifts, the always sitting and having a conversation before anything of import is discussed. Staying away from the women. You never see them in Saudi, very rarely. Don't spit on the ground, and never swear, never raise your voice, never show anger. I asked a kid, so you played with matches underneath your aunt's dining room table. It caught fire and started to burn down the room. I said, what? And I knew his dad. What did your dad? Was your dad mad? He goes, oh, he was. I said, did he hit you? No, never, never. Did he spank you or anything? Never. Did he raise his voice? No. I said, well, how do you know he was mad? He said, there's a vein above his eye. And when that vein starts bulging, I know he's mad. I said, so that's pretty interesting. Were you reprimanded? Yes. What did you have to do? He said, I had to read the Quran aloud for half an hour every night. And I said, well, I guess you probably learned something, huh? And his name was Abdulayla Darandari. And his father was Osama. His father is in our book. Osama is a character, is an individual in our book. So that's just a few of the stories. There are so many. And the what Lawrence saw, we saw. We felt it. We felt the purity of the desert, the extremity of the heat, the lopping nature of camels, but the genuine graciousness of the people with nothing and people with a lot. So it was, that was universal. And yeah, there were times it was tense, for sure. And not knowing which way it was going to go, but staying calm. And that's all part of the adventure. That's the adversity. The adversity can be lack of sleep. And you start getting your head just gets, you know, it's like, okay, focus. Where are we? We're coming into the King David Hotel. Okay. We just made it through immigration. We just got into the country. It took 6 hours. It's like there was no dramatizing anything that happened because it was all dramatic. You know what I mean? It was just the way it is. And so it was just go with the flow, adapt, and be alert. Not afraid. Just know where your feet are.
There's so many experiences and a lot of the things you said will tie in very well with things that are happening at the moment as well, but lack of communication and I don't know, a lack of will to understand all the people or the cultures or to actually sit down and you know, have an equal conversation. So, I mean, it's no wonder that a lot of people have said that your book, you know, is thought provoking, is something that makes people think in a different way, which is not, it's not what we're hearing 24/7. It's just something completely different, in a different way of approaching things. So, was this one of your aims? Would you say about this for this region specifically, to get people to understand things better of, you know, what's going on in this region, or it just happened to be there, but you know, it was something more universal, what you wanted to show? Obviously you were following the Lawrence, but you know, did you specifically go for this region to show that more emphatically?
I think that it was it wasn't a conscious objective. The objective, the intention was, and the adventure was to understanding. And we didn't know what that understanding would be. It overwhelmingly went in one direction, which was positive. And the tense, or the, what one would say, you were risking your life. That's, it's not that it's negative, it's that in that area, in that region, in that particular moment, it's like doing the crossing of the King Hussein Bridge, Allenby Bridge, on a bus. Bus is the lowest end you could do going from, because they were getting blown up. I mean, we had seen it on TV, you know, over the years, and terrorist bombings on buses. But we decided we wanted to experience as close to what people experience there, regardless of what it is. And so there's an atmosphere on the bus. There's an atmosphere finally getting off the bus and being able to breathe again, because it was so hot and sweaty and we didn't know what was going on. And there's guys with, you know, Taver assault rifles in jeans and work shirts. They weren't even in uniform walking around. There was only another bus 50 yards, one, you know, meters over there, and another one on the other side, 50 meters. They were kept apart. And we're there for an hour. The windows won't come down. Getting out, getting some air, great. Walking into immigration. And it was just like the volume button was turned up on high. And it was shocking. But that was the nature of the real experience. It wasn't people trying to do, it was concern and fear for safety. The Israeli agents, immigration agents, were aggressive because they wanted to be clear. And they said, when they said, step back, I mean, everything was given like an order. We had just come from the Middle East where no one raised their voice. There was no yelling. There was no loud laughter display of anything. It was quiet. And suddenly to be thrust into this world, it was like Grand Central Station. I mean, that's a phrase we use here, Grand Central Station out of New York, but it could be, you know, De Gaulle, it could be some, anywhere in the world, Madrid, you know. I only know Bilbao in Spain. Right? We flew in there to do Pamplona. But so what we wanted to do with the book, and we decided to write the book after, you know, the book was written post 9/11, and it addresses some things about 9/11. October 7th, 2023, we'd spent so many years on the play, and our thought aside from normal work, other work, was on the play. and the voluminous notes going to different writers, and these are great writers, but it just didn't fit. You know, it does now. We have a female writer and she's American. All the other writers were British. Known, I don't need to tell you their names, I won't, because they don't have the contract. But it was to join the narrative with what we experienced. And that was the reason for writing the book, and write it so that we could draw the reader in so they could get the information and maybe it resonates with them, you know. And we've found with the reviews we've had between US and international reviews, we're like 800 some odd reviews now. And they all comment on the history. They didn't know, or it was so good, or, you know, I know there are details about the book, but the history, and that's what we wanted. And the current affairs, the geopolitics of today. And so when things got tough, there was a reason for it to be tough, because at any moment, someone could have a vest on and ba-boom. Even the security there in 2005 wasn't like what we see even here. They didn't have all the metal detectors, and no, it's just glass doors. You open it up and, you know, there's a row of all the immigration people, and it's loud, and you see people's belongings getting somewhat tossed out of their bags as people are going through everything to make sure there's nothing coming into the country, a bomb primarily. And the immigration people have assault rifles right there. They're saying passport, but right at their knee, their hip, is a Taver, you know, bullpup. It's like an AK-47. There's no messing around.
Wow, it's a pretty tough environment to be in. And kind of move, you know, you touched on the political dimensions of this book and the social dimensions, and you touched on a little bit there also the kind of mechanics of writing and, you know, finding the correct writer for this, you know, for one of your projects. And I guess maybe the final question we can ask you could be related to that, because you co-wrote this book, which is something myself and Maria have done. And people always ask us about that. It blows their minds that two people can write a book together. And you've mentioned the mountain of reviews you've received, which is something that really impressed me when I was researching for this interview. And I know as well that your book was number one on Amazon, like the number one history book in Syria, Saudi, and Jordan on Amazon, which is quite an achievement. So we're really interested to know, what do you consider success as a writer? And would it differ from the definition of your co-writer, Miles Spencer?
Success. Well, I think getting it published was the first level of success. We both agree. Don't you? I mean, just getting it out. And that was great, great fun. I loved the writing, and so did Miles, and we approached it in different ways. He's, you know, the way the ideas, you know, just flow, they just came in, and it was a lovely experience and very fast, because we had the experience when you're put in life and death situations or a threat of that for a period of time, you don't forget. I just can conjure up moments and days, and so can Miles, and we can sit here and rehash specific days and times and going through this castle or this or that or this person, because it just, we were so alert. The success, I think that it comes with people that say thank you, you know? Or a review that's good. It means someone bought it or not somehow. And they, it's a positive response. And we're on to our next book, deeply involved with our next book. And it's Magnus and Finn continuing the adventure of to understanding. And the next book, and it's on Amazon. We're already have it posted to pre-sale the Kindle version, and it's called Havana Familia. And so it is Havana 1958 mm-hmm. and present day 2016. Whereas, you know, we had 1917 and 18 as the back date, and 2006 was the present date in A Line in the Sand. But in A Line in the Sand, the what we express there has just gone, you know, 100-fold more serious and more outrageous with the October 7th and then the retribution that's been exercised on from both sides, Hamas and Israeli. So success, hey, I'm talking with you. That's a level of success. And this has been an adventure.
It's you've allowed us very generously. We used that word about you earlier in the interview, generous, generosity. We've, you know, traveled vicariously through your experiences, many and as rich and as varied as they are. We want to wish you tremendous success with your follow-up book, and also with this book, A Line in the Sand. We will definitely put a link to that in the description, and we encourage our readers to go out and seek this book. It's very well reviewed. You've heard the writer speak so passionately about the book over the course of this interview, so we hope as well that people go out and seek more information and read more of your work. So at this moment in time, I guess, Wells, I would like to say thank you so much for being here with us.
And that was very lovely of you to say all that. Thank you very much. And Maria, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Wells. It was brilliant. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.